Welcome to the Wizard of Whiskey podcast, the podcast dedicated to the hedonist lifestyle. Today is February 11th, and this is a special Valentine's Day episode where I spoke with Stephen Kent Mirisau of Stephen Kent Winery in Livermore. So, just to clarify, my Livermore trip was one day. I managed to get so much content, so many interviews, sit down with so many great winemakers in just the span of one day that I had enough to do at least 5 podcast episodes. The reason I say that this is a Valentine's Day special episode is that the wines of Livermore Valley pair so exceptionally well with food that you should go out in the next few days, pick up a bottle of Cab Franc or Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot from Livermore. Grab yourself a chocolate mousse, grab yourself a steak, grab yourself a roasted duck breast with fig jam, and have an exceptional Valentine's Day.
Stephen, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. Excellent. Welcome to Livermore.
Oh, thank you. It's I love the area. It's gorgeous out here, and it's a gorgeous day.
It is a beautiful day. It's a little chilly for us, but it has been beautiful the last couple of days. Chilly, but overall, yeah, this area is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, I have to say I love the lush green hills that just kind of envelop this place. It's really,
you're here at the right time because under normal circumstances, you get into sort of middle of March, everything's brown. Brown again until, you know, November, December rain. So it's a 14-inch a year rainfall area. So really, really dry. But it has been growing amazing fruit for 150 years here. And we're proud and excited to be making wine from this appellation.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about Livermore. You said it's not a lot of rainfall, so I'm assuming pretty dry climate. What why make wine here?
Well, you know, it's under normal circumstances. Again, if you're a fourth or fifth generation winemaker in a place, you followed in the footsteps of people who have done a lot of the hard work ahead of time. You know, figured out that the climate does support, you know, what you want to do from a winemaking standpoint, that you can grow a variety of different grapes here, that they get ripe, that you can still maintain acidity, all the things that you want to have from a viticultural standpoint. And people knew that about Livermore in the 1840s. Grapes were planted here then, really became the preeminent wine-growing place in California in the 1870s and 80s. Charles Wetmore was an agricultural commissioner, first one in California. There's a lot of stuff named for him in this area, you know, knowing, you know, why this area. Charles Wetmore comes to the area. He sees the soil. He experiences the weather. He talks to some of the people who are growing grapes here already, one of whom was a guy named Louis Mell, who actually had a vineyard planted sort of right behind us, where Myriad as well winery is now. And Louis Mell was a friend of the Lursalus family, who Chateau Yquem fame, owned Chateau Yquem back in the 1870s. Still do, I think, for that matter, or own part of it anyway. And he got an introduction to two Bordeaux growers from the Lursalus family, from Louis Mell. He went out to Bordeaux, got cuttings from First Growth Bordeaux Chateau there, Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, brought them back to Livermore, planted them here. The first great wines made here were Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon blends. And the first international gold medal ever given to California wine was a wine made from those cuttings at Cresta Blanca Winery here, Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon. This area, we're about 700 feet above sea level on the valley floor. So we're 500 plus feet higher than you are in Napa Valley on the valley floor. We don't rise as precipitously on the valley sides. It's more of a bowl-shaped valley here. But what's interesting, one of the interesting things about Livermore is that it's an east-west oriented appellation. So the mouth of the of where we grow stuff is pointed at San Francisco Bay, and we're about 35 miles east of San Francisco. So every afternoon we get these great winds coming in from San Francisco, kind of right through the valley. Really cool things off in the evening, create this great diurnal temperature range that gives us great acidity in fruit. In the evening, it's about 88 degrees during the day. In July and August on average, so we get all the sun we need to get photosynthesis running at peak efficiency, and a lot of different soil types, a lot of different microclimates. So this area has been known for grape growing and excellence in grape growing for 150 years. Where the valley has fallen down, I think, or never really even stepped up the plate was from a marketing standpoint. You asked about Silicon Valley and its influence. My family's winery, the Mirasu property, was in the east side of San Jose and was planted back in the 1850s. And into the 1960s, my grandfather and great uncle at the time started to look elsewhere because they saw what was happening already. The bedroom community of San Jose was expanding. Fairchild hadn't gotten there yet, sort of a precursor to Apple and to Google and all the companies we know now. But they were aware that vineyard property was not as valuable as property for houses. And Livermore has kind of suffered that in a certain way in that it's become a bedroom community of San Jose almost. There's a lot of people who commute from this area down into San Jose every day. Although we have an amazing agricultural preserve, the Tri-Valley Conservancy here that will keep land in agriculture in perpetuity, it has created a sort of transient sense that you go up and down 580, 680, the two freeways here, without ever getting off the freeway to see what beautiful hillsides we have here, what beautiful grape growing area we have. And it's really, I think, hurt Livermore more from a marketing standpoint than it has from a grape growing standpoint. There's no real there in a lot of people's minds. And as we were talking about before, you know, before Prohibition, there were 50 plus wineries here. When we started Stephen Kent Winery in 1996, we were the 17th winery in the association. There are now closer to 60. So we've finally gotten past where we were, you know, in the 1880s, 1890s anyway. So it's stunted the message dissemination, I think, more than it has the grape growing and winemaking.
out of curiosity, just from a monetary standpoint, has Silicon Valley had an effect of people coming in with just truckloads of money and saying, hey, let's open a winery?
We're waiting for those people to show up, actually. If you know any of them, let me know.
Yeah.
Not yet. Okay. Not yet. I think it will happen. I think it will happen for a couple of obvious reasons. One, there's not a whole lot of land to buy in Napa anymore, unless you're buying it from somebody else and you're paying a gigantic premium. Most of the big wineries, I think it was Gallo, it may have been Constellation, but Gallo just bought the 600-acre Stagecoach Vineyard last year. There's a moratorium on vineyard planting and on winery building in Napa County, and people who want to get into the wine business are going to have to go someplace else. We are close to Silicon Valley, you know, so the proximity is a benefit to us. The agricultural and the inherent viticultural quality is certainly there. And I think as more and more people do better and better things wine-wise and the amenities start coming, more hotels, more restaurants, more, hey, I want to be in wine country for 2 days instead of 2 hours, you're going to see people saying, okay, well, yeah, finally, I got a place I can park some money. And, you know, the economy is going great guns for Silicon Valley right now. And, you know, we're hopeful that people who have the wherewithal financially and emotionally and from the standpoint of wanting to create great experiences for people and make great wine gravitate to our valley because there is room.
So I see 4 reds on the table, and I'm excited because I'm a huge red fan. I'm also a huge white fan.
But, great.
What do we have in our glass?
So what we have, Stephen Kent Winery is a Cabernet producer. We started out in 1996 making one Cabernet from Livermore, and the goal back then was to sort of prove our thesis, which was that you can make Cabernet from Livermore as good as Napa Valley Cab. Stylistically, it may be different, and what have you. But we've grown from one Cabernet to about 9 different cabs. And what you have in your glass now is a 2014 Home Ranch Cabernet. So we do 6 different single vineyard cabs as of the 2016 vintage. Home Ranch is where we are right now. So you look out the window, you see almost 3 acres of Cabernet, the historic Concannon clone of Cabernet. This was these were the cuttings that were brought by Wetmore back to California in the 1870s. Margaux, Chateau Margaux, apparently was the progenitor of this particular budwood. And now clone 7 cab, the Concannon series of clones is, 70% of the Cabernet grown in California.
Right away I can tell I'm not in Napa.
Yay.
And there's, and me there's too. Nothing wrong.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that
at all.
Huge fan, so I love you, Napa, but sometimes I need my palate, for the rest of the day.
Exactly. One of the things that I've said over the years in talking to people is, we wanted to be the first people from Livermore to do something great, not the 400th guy from Napa. That story's been told ad infinitum, if not ad nauseum, to this point. And we wanted to create a different story for ourselves, and really a story through wine, and a story through, treating individual sites in a manner we think is appropriate for them, but also trying to create something that's beautiful, something that has acidity, something that has structure there, certainly, and ageability, but that creates a hopefully a more emotional response with the drinker, rather than just something that as you said, you kind of get in your mouth and it becomes like boiling a soup, right? You want to get out of your mouth quickly because it's just so rough and it's so tannic, and it's not a particularly pleasurable experience. Those food shows where you got to eat all those weird things, are horrible.
Yeah,
they're a blight on civilization. And I think that wines that are, way too tannic, way too big, way too extracted, and need forever to come around are similar in that vein. They just, what purpose do they really serve? And so we make a style of wine that is based really on the kind of wine we want to drink.
I appreciate that very much. I would consider this, and correct me by all means, but I would say something along the lines of bold yet restrained. This is, it's intense. It's fruit forward. I still get tons of earth.
Yeah.
What I don't get is, beaten to death by tannins, but they're there.
Right.
And it's just really nice. And I want. I'm assuming steaks are on the way. Just
yes,
out of curiosity.
Yes, lunch will be served shortly.
Yeah, even a steak sandwich, whatever. But yeah, I agree with you. I think we, even eating competitions. You mentioned something along those lines. I don't understand having to consume a ridiculous amount of something in a short period of time. Where's the enjoyment of that? I just don't.
Wine drinking is not supposed to be a test.
No,
it's not supposed to be a test of your. Whatever, faux courage or, iron stomach or whatever it is that those people, are after, those whatever. Wine can be dramatic, I think, and still be, like you say, restrained, elegant, bold. I think that, what I would extrapolate from your comments is, this is a balanced wine. Cool. This is a wine that has stuffing, a wine that has acidity, a wine that shows a varietal correctness, as it were, but and a wine that's exciting for me. I mean, I just love the pace of the wine through the mouth is important to me, as not only a drinker but as a winemaker. I mean, I want to have that wine kind of stand up and introduce itself when it's there in the middle of your mouth in an elegant way. Here I am. I have a lot to tell you, and by the time we get to the bottom of the bottle, you're going to hear a lot of stories. You're going to, that's kind of the dialogue that I'm trying to create with these wines. And this site, the first site, the second site we ever used for Cabernet production, the vineyard was planted in '96. So first vintage, we used a little bit in 2000. Was the first time we used the fruit from this vineyard, and it's very there's 800 feet of gravel here. This is an old riverbed that kind of runs here underneath Concannon down the road. And it always produces fleshy wines with structure there, which is without having to add to, you know, we probably use, I don't know, 60% new barrel, but barrels specifically chosen to give structure and not flavor impact and aromatic impact. I don't think you get a lot of new wood in the nose on this one.
I get a little bit of the vanilla, but that's just, I have a super sensitive vanilla palate because I'm a big whiskey guy.
Right.
Other than that, no, I get it. It's very well balanced. And frankly, I think you and I are similar in this regard. I want a wine that is balanced throughout. I've tasted, just in this notebook alone, there's probably 100-something wines just from 2 or 3 days of tasting.
Right.
You'll get wines that are bold and just over extracted on the nose and just, oh, okay, there it is. And then it's just dead on the palate. Mm-hmm. And then there's no finish. Or you'll get something that's crazy on the finish, lacking on the palate, nothing on the nose. And you're just like, what? Why? What is this? You know?
Right.
And it is what it is. I mean, it's the wine. You know, it's the wine industry. I get it. And,
sure.
You know, not everyone can make a perfect wine, but if I had to say, just, you know, for me, this home ranch is pretty damn close because it just has everything that you want with nothing out of balance.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, we do things very simply here. We ferment in, 1.5-ton, basically plastic containers that are in a pine enclosure. And, everything is done at ambient temperature, at least to the 2017 finish. And we did some changes there, and I think that we'll have some interesting results because of that. But my assistant winemaker and I, now my son, so the three of us, are the winemaking team. And, you know, we do some native yeast ferments for Chardonnay. We've had zero luck doing it for Cab. I don't know what it is. Whatever that dominant strain in the winery is, produces a red wine that's incredibly tart and red and doesn't resemble Cabernet at all. It's really odd. So we have a stable of, four or five different yeasts that we use to inoculate with. But I think the most important part of wine in terms of creating the style that we want to create and creating that sense of balance and pace is the structure of the wine. You know, we've been using the same vineyards for a while. We use the same coopers with one or two changed in or out, in a given couple of years. So we have a good sense of what the fruit's going to give us and what the barrels are going to give us from an organoleptic standpoint, from that flavor and aroma standpoint. But it's really in the textural component of the wine that you can do a bit more molding. You can do a bit more in terms of lengthening the wine or a bit more in terms of polishing some tannins or what have you. We've done a lot of extended maceration in the past, and which necessitates sort of getting your arms down into the wine every day and tasting and making notes. And once things start, stop bouncing around as they do early on in fermentation, even when the wines are sort of newly dry, then we're ready to press. So everything is done very individualistically, very much a fermenter by fermenter kind of process, and it's time consuming, but it's a wonderful way of sort of seeing these each of these bins is like its own world, and they ferment at different times, even though it's the same fruit with the same yeast, pressed, crushed at the same time. It's just such a fascinating thing to experience during harvest time. Wine number two, Gilmedi Vineyard. So our second estate vineyard, about 3.5 miles east of us, 64 acres. Four different clones of Cabernet now, four additional clones planted last year. So this vineyard is mostly, it's planted to practically all Bordeaux variety. There's a little bit of Grenache, Petit Sirah, and Syrah. We do have the white Bordeaux varieties there as well. This is really one of the jewels in the valley from a site standpoint. Up about 1,000 feet above sea level, up against Altamont Pass, the eastern foothills here. It tends to push later in the spring, harvest later in the fall. It's cooler there than it is here by a couple of degrees. So this is a blend of clone 4, the Mendoza clone of Cabernet, clone 337, clone 6, the Jackson clone, and then clone 30, which is the Disney clone or the C clone, S-E-E clone of Cab. So you have sort of more potential for built-in complexity because you're using different clones that all taste separately, all taste differently, made separately, and then blended back into a
kind of a finished wine ultimately.
And so again, this is an incredibly well balanced wine, and I wouldn't necessarily go as far to, as far as to say that it's an old world wine, but it's definitely has that to me a little bit more minimally driven, a little bit more less oak, less fruit driven, mm-hmm. more more terroir driven.
I agree with you. There is a little bit more of that, I think, darker fruit note, kind of tinged with mineral crushed rock, kind of earthy, sort of almost not petrichor exactly, but there is a sort of wet earth kind of quality in a good way there, yeah. that I like a lot too.
Yeah, I like to call that chocolatey silt.
Yes, you know? I like that
chocolatey silt. Yeah.
Chocolatey silt, that's good.
Yeah. When I was in college, I wanted to take an earth science class. We had to take a science, and I was like, oh, earth science would be a great class for me because I could, geek out about the soils, and it wasn't anything like that.
Right.
But,
Right.
Because the first time you lick a rock in a classroom, people were like, what? Who is this guy? Right. What is he doing?
Right.
So, not what I want, but I did learn a considerable amount about the geology, and so I will geek out on mineral. And I'm curious, the basin here, is it a lot of loamy soils, or is it okay? That makes sense.
There at Gilmedi, where this wine's from, there are six different soil types that run through the vineyard. There's the Zamora silt loam series, the Perkins loam series. There are a number of others whose names have escaped me for the moment. Different than right here, which is practically all gravel. Just a little bit of topsoil on the top, and you dig down a little bit, you get gravel, riverbed gravel. But yeah, they're at this site up top of the hill, it tends to be a little bit more. Although it's not really classified as a clay by the USGS anyway, the particle size is larger, and it tends to be more adobe like when it rains. A lot of contraction and expansion cracks and the like. But when you go down to the bottom of the hill where most of our Bordeaux variety, the red, the high-end stuff that we're using, much, much finer grain soil, lighter in color, better draining. So there's a lot of variability up at this site in terms of not only soil series and the like, but there are a couple of arroyos that run through it. So there are aspect differences, 45 degrees off of, north and south and east and west in various areas. So it's a really interesting site.
Speaking of moneyed interest coming into an area, my very first trip out to Napa, I flew out from Chicago, that's where I'm from originally, mm-hmm. and it was January 2014, and it was like 90 degrees outside.
Mm-hmm.
My father let me, use his convertible. He's like, yeah, take it. And I was like, all right, cool. So I get out from Sacramento, I get out to Napa, and I pull up the driveway, and I get out, and I start taking pictures like I always do. There's about 20 guys working out in front, and this foreman comes over. He's like, hey, man, what are you doing? I said, hey, well, I'm just taking pictures. I have an appointment at the winery. And I'm like, yeah, this is somebody's house. So, this guy, it's like, dude, these guys spent like 50 mil on this, hill, and there's vineyards around it. And I'm like, what the? So I'm completely confused. I saw the sign for the winery, and he's like, no, the winery's down the hill. It's that little dumpy building over there. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm getting in my car, and I see the older couple. They're driving up, and they're they've got their Starbucks in their hands. I'm like, first of all, I don't even see a Starbucks. It was just funny, the amount of money, pouring into, these wine regions. If I had it, I would do it in a second. I would just.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would ever actually make wine. I'm not at that level. But definitely just have a nice house. My neighbors are making good stuff.
Well, it there really is no more beautiful landscape than a vineyard.
No.
I'm lucky in that I live in the middle of Gilmedi Vineyard, and it's a little bit of an old ranch house that was built back in the 70s, and it doesn't matter how dumpy it is. I get to wake up in the morning and look down the vineyard at the western side of the valley and say, Jesus, look at this, I'm here every day. And the amount, there's the money thing's always a complicated issue in a way. There are people who have a lot of money and great taste, and there are people with a lot of money and no taste, and vice versa. it you know, this is a very capital intensive business, but you know, you certainly can make amazing wines in places other than Napa Valley or other than, you know, Sonoma if you're trying to make Pinot Noir or what have you. And you don't need to live in a mansion either in order to do it. It's really about connection to, you know, the place where you get your fruit from.
Right, man.
Yeah, but I know those people. They probably had a Starbucks in their basement.
Probably, yeah. It's all right. Lineage. Interesting.
Yeah, so Lineage. Lineage is it. The one wine that when we started back in 96, as I told you earlier, you know, my dad and I started the brand, and I started out in the sales end of the business and gravitated toward the production side until the point where I was, you know, leading my little winemaking team on all the production that we were doing. And we have a lot of wine club members here. That's, you know, Livermore is close to Napa, it's close to San Francisco, but it when you're doing a project like we're doing, especially on the Lineage side, when you're basically, you know, you're throwing your glove down, you're sort of spitting, you know, tugging on Superman's cape, as it were. We're trying to create a Bordeaux blend that can be that literally, and I'll say it as immodestly as it may sound, we're after first growth Bordeaux and we're after the best stuff from Napa Valley. That's who we believe our competitive set will be at some point. We'll be in that set at some point in time. And I kind of came to the conclusion after making a lot of different kinds of wines for club members, various varietal sets, Barones and Italians and the like, that I needed to focus again on trying to create one wine that would be sort of the wine that you know, would be on my tombstone wine, as it were. You know, this guy made this wine. And in 2007, it was a great harvest in California. Everything came in beautifully, and I was able to play around in the winery with a bunch of varieties that we had used sparingly up to that point in time, relatively sparingly anyway. And we made our first vintage of Lineage in 07. You know, it was very expensive for Livermore. It got really good press. And as the wine has evolved, it's showcasing more and more of that structure that I wanted to showcase. It's different every year, obviously. We harvest all blocks of Cab separately, all blocks of Cab Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Malbec separately. And then everything gets, and then we spend a year and a half of blending to put together, you know, the wine that we'll ultimately put together. 13 and 14 are real departures for us in kind of the history of the blend, in that Cabernet Franc plays a huge role in this wine. It's 30% of the blend in 13 and 35% of the blend in 14. So if we're looking at wines, you know, we're looking at Insignia, we're looking at Opus 1, we're looking at Dominus, we're looking at wines like that from Napa, those wines don't approach... The Cabernet Franc is not nearly as great a player in the blend there than it is here. Right. Two obvious reasons for me. One real obvious reason is that I love Cabernet Franc. It may be my favorite variety at this point in time. And it does such great things with the blend in terms of pace and sexiness and aliveness and all those different things that we're looking for. And also helps to separate us from Napa Valley. You know, we're making a different blend. You know, we're pitching ourselves as, you know, competitors ultimately, but have a different vision, you know, of a vision again of grace and of elegance and the like, that that is really exciting for me, and I just love what the Cab Franc brings to this particular blend.
You mentioned earlier you were listening to an old episode, and it just happened to be a Cab Franc episode. I was excited to do those because it gave me the opportunity to do Cab Franc verticals. And I did, I think with that program with the Finger Lakes, I went through like 117 wines. And a lot of them were older. And I was like, send me your library, because that's how you can show people that you're ageable.
Right.
You have ageability.
Right.
You know, everyone, you know, can talk about the new releases, and that's the industry, and
sure,
I get it. But
sure.
And we were tasting 05 Cab Franc, and I was like, wow, this is incredible.
That's
this
really
from
cool.
Upstate New York.
That's really, really cool.
Know, Central New York, for those people who live in upstate New York. but this is, parts of it remind me of something you would get out of the Loire Valley. Just, you know, mineral driven Cab Franc, and I really appreciate that. And I, you know, I'm a huge Cab Franc fan, you know, myself. So,
I
so thank you.
Yeah, well, my pleasure. Thank you. I love pouring wine for people who appreciate it and love it. You know, it's 13 was a great vintage for California, and it was a vintage where everything came in with sort of, you know, 23.8 to 24.5 bricks and the Finger Lakes, for instance. We unless we make a very considered decision to harvest at 20 bricks or 20 and a half or what have you, you rarely get that in California. You rarely get flavor development that is on pace at that point in time that you can get those kinds of wines with that ripeness. I love Chenin, I love Borgoy, I love Semur. Those, you know, that appellation for Cabernet Franc was one of my favorites, and Chenin Blanc from Loire as well. There's something really unapologetic about the wines, sexy. You know, they're not trying to be Bordeaux Cab Franc. They are themselves, and it's a really beautiful thing to taste and to drink, when I think about what that wine does, and we do 100% version of Cab Franc here too, and if we have time, I'll pour you the 15, which I have called Chenonifornia, and I'm not sure how I feel about wine. It was just bottled about a week ago, so it's a little rough right now, but this is about as as sort of green as you can get in California, and we can talk about that later. But the role of this variety in the blend is phenomenal.
Yeah, that's killer. If I had to use one word to describe Chenin, it would be finesse.
Yes.
Which does not mean lacking or feminine. It just means it takes a little bit to coax out of, you know.
Absolutely. So that's a great word. Deftness, you know, is another synonym for that. There's a, you know, winemakers make a lot of choices throughout the course of the season. You know, and if they're involved in the vineyard, there are that many more decisions that they're making. And you can choose to harvest at 28 bricks, and you can choose to add enzymes and add tannin at the crush pad. You can choose to do a bunch of different things. You know, to that are all legal. They're all sort of winemaking. They're both market-driven decisions and winemaking style-driven decisions. We try to stay out of the way to as much a degree as we can, while still working to make sure that the end product is something that's consistently of the place and of the variety. Every year is different, and that's something that's really fun. 2014, you know, 12, 13, and 14 was a string of three amazing vintages in California. Weather was perfect throughout. Still in the drought at that point in time, so you know we didn't get any real rain at all during harvest. Rare here in Livermore anyway. And as I said before, we pick a lot later than Napa Valley picks. So by the time Napa's got all their cab in, we're just starting picking Cabernet from Gilmetti anyway. You know, and in 14, I look at 14 as a vintage as a little bit more, sprightly than 13. A little bit more acid driven. A little bit redder fruit expression on the cabs. Certainly has finesse. Certainly has mouth filling quality to it. But just as a vintage to vintage observation, 13. Up until 17, I thought was the best vintage that I'd worked with in Livermore. 14 was right there, though. And then for us looking at the blends again, Cabernet Franc in 14 was just beautiful again, and it was even maybe more Cab Franc-ish than 13 was. And so we added 5% more, took out 5% Merlot, same amount of Cab, 50% Cabernet. Clone 30 is the predominant clone, and Gilmetti Vineyard is the predominant source for the Cabernet for the blend.
That is very nice. It's well-rounded. Again, balanced. great tannins that don't, you know, that don't snipe you around.
Thank you very much. These wines are obviously very young.
Oh yeah.
But I shouldn't say but. And I think they're going to age really well. You know, that acid component is very much an aging quality also in wine. So it's. I think that we'll be drinking these wines quite happily 15, 20 years down the road.
Yeah. Absolutely, and I appreciate that you said that, because so many people think that tannin is the only thing right. that can get you to an ageability.
Right.
And it's acid, it's balance, and there's a lot of things. Because, I mean, I've tasted wines that are, you know, I mean, you can spread what's left in the bottom of the bottle on crackers, and
right.
that's a very good, you know,
right.
it's a nice snack, by the
right.
way. But, you know, you know, it loses so much fruit. It loses so much
yeah.
of its, if it's not already balanced and not already, you know, good on acid, then, you know, it's just going to be, it's just going to exist, and it's not going to be anything that's.
That's, I think, that's, and that's an important point, I think, for wine drinkers, is that, you know, if a wine doesn't have balance going in or a sense of balance going in, it's not going to have a sense of balance coming out.
Right.
You know, if it's overly tannic, if there's no acidity, it doesn't magically gain these things after 20 years.
Right.
Tannin soften, they'll tannin change, lengthen, you know, and they soften and that sort of thing. And if there's a lot of new oak, that oak tends to recede into the blend as a whole. And so more layers get revealed, but not enough fruit there to begin with. You have a soft wine that's 20 years old, no fruit, nothing interesting really there anyway.
Yeah, I never had the palate to invest in first growth.
Yeah.
So pretty much my collection consists of, you know, a few things here and there. There's a lot of third and fourth growth.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a couple of fifths in there, in fact. And they're
beautiful wines. Absolutely.
Yeah,
ageable,
wines,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
When I was coming up in the industry, I started stocking up a little bit on the 03s
mm-hmm.
As they were coming out, and, you know, a little 04, not very much 05, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, here and there. But that's where I cut my teeth, was Bordeaux. You know,
right.
You know, that's
right.
where I all started. So.
That's how a lot of, my father's generation, that was where he cut his teeth anyway. You know, and that was where a lot of this California Cabernet, you know, California Cabernet isn't like Bordeaux. You know, the wines were made back in the 70s, you know, the Paris tasting wines and all, like, those wines were a lot harder tannin-wise. They were a lot lower in alcohol. They weren't made in a plush style like we make them now for the most part.
Right.
So those wines were needed some age on them. California Cab, even high-end Cab, doesn't really need that much age.
Right.
Hopefully you'll get interesting evolution over time,
yeah.
You know, if the wines are well made to begin with. But that's not necessarily something you have to do in order to have something that tastes really good. That lineup behind you there, we did a tasting about a year ago, 2010 vintage, blind, for about 25 people here. So all five of the first growths, Harlan and Lineage, all 2010. And the 10 vintage of Bordeaux was a great vintage, one of the legendary vintages in the last, you know, 50 years or so. And that's the order of finish. So we finished third out of this stable of wines, and Lineage is about $160 a bottle. Everything there is nothing less than about $800-$900
exactly.
a bottle.
Yeah, it was
$5,200 worth of wine there.
Yeah,
yeah.
So,
that was interesting.
yeah, I never understood, and in fact, I just wrote an article that was actually for school. It wasn't for I'm just finishing an MBA.
Oh, okay, cool.
And It was a little harsh, I get it, on Screaming Eagle, but at the same time, I'm just not sold on the quality versus the cost, and I get it. It's a production level, you know, thing, and it's if I'm spending 2 years on a wait list or something, it had better be the absolute most amazing thing that's ever existed, and realistically, it better be a trip to Mars.
We're not a record here, are we? This was a picking decision. This was about having a block of Cabernet Franc that had variable ripeness, variable sugar levels in the samples we were taking at the time, and wanting to make a wine that was not Chenin, but that was very much, you know, of that, you know, finesseful, deft, had those dark fruit components, those sort of exotic wood burning of like the aromas of you know, a beach fire, you know, the next day, that kind of thing. And I made a picking decision that ended up being perhaps wrong. We'll see. Maybe a little bit early, because this wine really does stride that sort of Pirozzini line. I think it comes out on the right side of the line. I think the wine's really interesting, and I love the wine. But it's also low in alcohol, high in acid, and very much of the variety. 20% new oak, so there's not a lot of wood to hide anything here. It's 13.0 alcohol.
Yeah, I definitely get the acid. But I also get this cigar box quality that I enjoy.
Yeah.
And just really, really quickly to the listeners, and while Steven's here, I just want to mention, you'll hear a lot of these descriptors, and it's not necessarily just us trying to say fancy words, or you know, it's a way of us communicating what we find in the wine. So when I say cigar box, that indicates to me, you know, something very specific, which is, you know, oak, but not overpowering. You know, kind of that cedar drawer type of oak where you smell and you get, you know, you get wood, but you don't get, you know, a ton of vanilla, a ton of oak, or you don't get a ton of smoke. So,
right.
So that's all that is. Granted, some people do take it too far, as we were talking earlier.
But, yeah, I mean, it's how do you describe the color orange to somebody who's never seen orange before? I mean, that's the same. That's that kind of, you know, that sort of classic. Everybody's tastes are different. You know, everyone's taste is different. Everyone's ability to smell is different. Some people, you know, are super tasters and can't take bitter stuff. Some people can smell certain things and not other things. It's difficult. It's a difficult mode of communication to try to speak the same language about something that's sensorial. You know, so. Yeah, I mean, the more that people drink and the more that they read about stuff, the more these words, you know, kind of get, they're limited. So the number of different adjectives, while they may seem daunting at first, really aren't that many.
All right, this is probably a good place to end the podcast. Steven, thank you so much. This was an exceptional experience.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure talking with you. It was great. Thanks for tasting.
If you're ever out in Livermore, or you know what? Quite frankly, you should just come out to Livermore. Get out here. Steven Kent Winery.
Thank you very much. Look forward to seeing you.